Part two today with Mary Taylor and Richard Freeman, wisely living their lives, trusting the process, and sharing insights with their latest book, When Love Comes to Light. I'm Robin with Tributaries.
Readiness of heart really would be rooted in, number one, the visceral experience of being able to drop into your physical experience of the moment and trust. And once you have that and you've had a taste of it, it's not something that it happens once and then, oh, good, for the rest of your life, you just walk around in this bliss state. It's this sort of waking up to the multidimensional, multi-layered experience. And these things start to happen when you do a contemplative practice. And many people, I'm sure, who are listening to this broadcast are people who do some form of embodied experience. Yes. or contemplative practice. You know, you run into two problems. One is that you want to recreate it, or you think that I've had it, therefore I don't have to practice anymore because I've already had it, I'm enlightened. Those are stumbling blocks because it is this response to circumstance that has sparked that experience. And so once you've had it and realize what it tastes like, then you start noticing it elsewhere and you're not grasping at it, but you start feeling it elsewhere and it sort of spills out into other aspects of life. And that's when it starts to feel more grounded and more consistent and more real, because it is something that is not something you want, but something that is actually allowing you to be of service and allowing you to be connected to the world in a very intimate way. So that's been my experience with it. It's something that sort of arises and then let it be and let it go and not hold on to it. And then maybe it comes again. And if not this lifetime, maybe again in the next life.
Yeah, but yeah, it might be coming again, but in a different form.
Yeah,
of course.
You're
not,
yes,
noticing.
Because it's always there. You just haven't seen it.
You're not looking. Yeah. I think, you know, one place where we experience it, and everyone does to a certain point, is sometimes just getting to look at some other people, you know, that you've kind of been a little bit shy about or have miscategorized, and then actually communicating with them. And there's actually some kind of spark, you know, if only for a second, in which you go, oh, they're me and I am them. Like in Thailand, we would occasionally experience people who were actually tribal people from Myanmar, hill people. And they didn't speak Thai and they didn't speak, but they were so sweet once you
looked them in the eyes.
Once you, yeah, you know, just tried, it was like, wow. And so I think that's what the world needs, is for people to take the chance. I don't know whether it's reaching out or being diplomatic or
being open.
Yeah.
You know,
being skillful.
Why not take that risk? Because it feels good on both sides. You know, you're missing out if you don't.
In relation to like the Black Lives Matter and the huge divisions that are being created here, and in fact all around the world, you know, the people who want to control, they create these divisions where people refuse to reach out to each other because the other is so terrible. And then when you hear about someone doing it, it's like, oh, it makes your day.
That's one of these great things of these times, is that we are in this together. And when we can really look deeply and openly, let people look deeply into our eyes as well, something palpable and important happens that can be transformative.
And I loved when you wrote about trusting the limitless shared reservoirs of love. Using the word shared in there is so key.
And then the ego comes in and says, no, it's mine. Then you go, wait a minute, wait a minute. that's when the trouble begins. And that's human nature. If you can just see that human nature is to grasp onto things, to then try to brand yourself, try to market yourself, try to hold onto everything for yourself. And then you just laugh at yourself for doing what is completely human. Then you can begin.
Yeah, you can forgive yourself and others. Yes. Insanity.
Yeah. Maybe we need a spoiler alert here, but you write that an underlying theme early on in the Gita is that nothing happens in our awakening. And then later, I believe you wrote what later is called yoga. And Richard, can you address that? Was I quoting that correctly? Or
that nothing happens in the awakening. We're playing with words because you're having the mystical experience, the awakening, and it is merely pure observation. And what you're observing is that there's nothing there that can be grasped onto to be owned or identified. So there's nobody looking at nothing in the experience. And yet it's the nicest, it's so wonderful that you kind of let go of everything else.
And you can't hold on to it.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, if you don't notice it, it passes by without you experiencing it. And so again, this is this process of everything arising in wave patterns and being able to ride those waves and trust the process rather than an end result or getting stuck somewhere clinging onto a wave pattern. You have to really ride it in order to awaken and yet not be attached to the idea of awakening.
Yeah. So the experience doesn't make you special. And it doesn't even give you special formulas or special knowledge, but it's much nicer than any of that.
Yes, indeed. Richard, I know you've done a lot of lectures and you've both done teaching. Where do you think we're at as a population of seekers, perhaps, with understanding surrender? Or maybe where are you at? Where are you at? Truly understanding surrender.
Yeah.
Not unlike the Gita, there's a lot of layers in there.
Yeah, we can interpret surrender as being putting everything down as an offering to others. It doesn't mean you're accepting a particular authority or not. It's just like you're taking the whole thing and you're kind of placing it down in front of just pure awareness, in front of all beings, and saying, hey. And so you're sharing that with them.
And in spiritual communities and communities at large, there can be misinterpretation of what it means to surrender, often turn into a power dynamic. That kind of surrender is giving up your autonomy, giving up your intelligence.
And with a deep motive.
That. And that's, you know, an insidious part of many cultures and many spiritual groups, etc., too. That happens. But what we're talking about is actually more a thing of honesty and truth. And in the Gita itself, we point out that Krishna persists in coming down off of the pedestal upon which Arjuna has placed him, which we tend to do with our teachers or with our ideals. And Krishna consistently comes down off the pedestal. And in that act is able also to surrender. I personally have a little bit of a, you know, the hair on the back of my neck stands up when I hear someone say, oh, you know, this is so empowering. The intention of that idea is fine, but to look for things that are empowering is looking for things that will separate rather than join together and set up a power dynamic. And what we're reading in the Gita and what we experienced from this is this idea that true surrender is an act of taking refuge and a deep trust. So giving trust and being trustworthy from all sides. And it begins with the trust of being able to authentically put everything down, lay your cards out on the table, and really put it down and communicate.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean they're bad cards or
no.
good cards.
No.
And it's totally the difference. Like, if you surrender to a psychopath, you know, just for survival, then that's, well, that seems to be a common card these days. But that's a mess.
Yeah, really paying attention in your interactions with the world and with others, and consciously asking yourself, what is my motive for doing X, Y, or Z? Because all of us have egos, and the ego serves a very good function, but you give it an inch and it takes, you know, 2 miles. And the motive starts to become self-serving when there's hesitation or when there's confusion or a sense of crisis, and you want something so badly or are aiming at something so fiercely, to pause and say, you know, what is my motivation here? Is it in line with what my beliefs and moral ground and intention
really are?
Really are. Because it's not necessarily going to line up.
I was just wondering, I know you've spent a lot of your life in the yoga study, in the tradition of India with the Gita. I'm wondering, is there another tradition that really speaks to you?
Well, I think we've both been influenced, of course, by different Buddhist schools, which are basically yoga schools in our view, and then by the Taoist schools in China. And I've had plenty of interactions with Sufis in the Middle East. Rumi, you know, he was a great yogi.
Mythology. I grew up with a father who was a humanities teacher, so he taught Greek mythology, and I learned about that as a tiny kid and looked at actually some of the same patterns in a Greek mythology. In a Greek myth, what happens is, you know, you go through this transformative process, which then spills over into psychology as well. But you go through the process of a woman, often, or a man being in control or in power or whatever. And then their life just starts going down the tubes, and they become the lowest of the low in whatever form they've taken. And it's at that point when they start then coming back from there that the transformation begins. That's always been this theme. So that's something that has always really grounded me. And as you were asking, I started thinking recently with the new Pope, I keep finding these quotes from him or listening to talks he's done, having been trained as a child in Catholicism and then being so disillusioned with that religion, but seeing now this resurgence of intelligence through some of the words that he uses with tenderness, that this is this time where tenderness is so important, or where we don't build walls, but we build bridges. And he continually is coming up with these wonderful statements of interaction. And so I think if we look around, these lessons are everywhere. You know, you find anything that strikes your fancy at the time, and then it can ground you. And from there, you start to get real.
Well, the beauty of it is it's all happening at the same time, right? Those experiences are more deeply felt and realized by your neighbor than perhaps you one day, and vice versa. And it's a lovely soup to be swimming in with all of the chaos that's going on, certainly.
Tell me
about writing this book. What did you gain, Richard and Mary, from writing this book?
Well, while we were working on the book, there was a great sense of freedom and satisfaction, even as both personal and then international and political circumstances were totally crazy. You know, the kind of thing that would just make you angry if you read the news too often. You weren't ignoring the situation, but you were also staying busy doing something that was of service and might be beneficial. It was a relief to work on it.
And I think it enriched our connection to each other, because we had to slow down and we had to listen to each other. And we had to be honest and say, that one doesn't quite work, or try this. Because we worked on the two different parts of the book separately.
And then together.
Mm. And so it was both, as Richard's saying, both in a worldly sense, but in a very, very personal sense, remembering how important it is to really connect deeply with the ones you love and care about, and how easy it is to just get trapped in routine and not notice who's right there with you.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely.
Earlier, Mary touched upon the embodied experience, and there's a very potent section in When Love Comes to Light that shares embodiment exercises. Richard, as one of our most embodied yoga teachers on the planet, can you speak to what is in that section and perhaps the thought process of why these particular exercises were chosen?
Well, I don't know if I'm embodied that well. Well, so much of the Gita is trying to gain this direct experience, that which is unutterably wonderful and divine. And by embodiment, we mean to really feel into the mystery and the miracle of your direct experience, which is more or less sensations. You know, even to describe them as sensations can be misleading. Here we are in these vehicles, which if you really feel them, look at them again and again, they're infinite. They are completely intermeshed, interwoven with the environment. So they say that if you have a good posture and if you're feeling the inhale and the exhale, you start to release all kinds of ego-based effort, and all of a sudden you start to experience infinity, not infinity conceptually, but and you have this amazing experience of that which is hard to describe. And so so much in the Gita is embodiment or direct experience. And so a lot of these embodiment exercises are very simple, but they're very simple yoga exercises. For example, like moving with the wave of the breath, that is the classic thing, because even when we watch our breath, we don't understand that it's a continuous wave pattern. And same for our mind. When we watch it, we don't understand it's a continuous wave pattern. What we say is, if you can feel the best of the inhale as you're exhaling and the best of the exhale when you're inhaling, then you have the two patterns simultaneously arising and you get stunned and you're in what we would call the middle path. And that stunning is the experience of infinity, or the actual experience of what you're enmeshed in, which is the body. Anyway, so
beautiful.
All of the exercises are basically yoga, simple yoga things.
Right. Well, I have to thank
anyone.
This book and your entire practice and teachings are bringing yoga back into the full embodied or full embodied experience. Yoga is not just for stretching anymore. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Occasionally you get to stretch, but
right. That's
and the
not
fact
all.
Is everyone has a body. If they can listen to this, they're embodied and they've got it right there. It's their immediate experience.
Yes.
And it doesn't take a special body, it just takes a body.
Right. And Mary, I wanted to ask you about your experience embodying this work when you're working with your Zen care group.
Ah, that's a great question. I work with the Being with Dying program through Upaya Zen Center. And actually, that has informed a lot of my take on the Gita, because it's been 20 years now of working with that group, training and working alongside medical professionals, bringing contemplative practices to the bedside and recognizing the importance of remaining in touch with the embodied experience as we are faced with complex situations, whether it be as the caregiver for another who is dying or very, very ill, or if we are involved in a difficult or complex relationship with another person or sentient being, or at this stage in the world, with the world at large. If we become disembodied, which is something that can happen pretty easily, if we become disembodied, we then go off into fantasy land in our minds, or we shut down and are not really able to resonate with the other or the situation to the point that we can tap into what it is that is really important in our approach to the world, our intentions, our motivations, and then look at what it is that we can contribute that will be of most benefit to the entire situation, rather than pulling back from the situation and then just trying to survive it, which is the natural instinct. But if we can soften in through the body, through the breath, to the specifics of complex or difficult situations, and then take a moment to pause, which is what bringing awareness to the embodied experience requires. It requires at least one exhale where you pause, and it's not like some dramatic, then I paused for 20 breaths and I did this. It's just really, truly tapping into what's going on in my physical experience at this very moment. We then have this wealth of knowledge and information about the situation we're involved in that all too often is overlooked, because the mind has become slightly unstable and ungrounded and is trying frantically to figure out what to do. In this day and age, it's just been brought to light. Working with the pandemic as someone in the medical profession is always a very complicated situation where their own needs often are put aside in order to show up, do whatever they can for their patients. They've taken an oath in their training to do that. And so often what happens with medical professionals is that they themselves get put aside. And that happens to us as well. We put ourselves aside in terms of our own experience and our own need to be grounded and be resilient in order to deal with the situation. And so they're not mutually exclusive things. You can take care of others. You can interface with the situation you're in elegantly and efficiently and in a compassionate way if you remain grounded in your embodied experience. Yeah. And that's kind of the way this has informed me. I'm able to see this, and then I find myself like everyone else in situations where I don't do a good job of it. But fortunately, I do notice that I've really blown it. And then I forgive myself and I come back and I try to forgive myself. That's what I'm working on. And then I come back and I say, okay, where do I go from here? And that's all any of us can do.
Yes, it's in that recognition, certainly. Would one of you share one of the embodiment exercises? Just something that's very simple and something we could share as we close out today.
Yeah, one of our favorites, and it's kind of the punchline of the book in a way, is at the very beginning of the story of the Gita, Krishna and Arjuna enter the battlefield, and they are, especially Arjuna, who's a warrior and a prince, and he's been training his whole life for just this moment to come into battle. And so you imagine what it feels like for any of us to find yourself in the situation that is exactly what you've been training for your whole life. And there you are. And so he's all pumped up. He's excited. They go onto the field. They hear all of the people blowing the conch shells in the background, and they're getting adrenaline rushes themselves, and they pull out their own conch shells to blow them, which signifies, yes, we're here, ready to go. And as he blows his conch shell, what happens is exactly what happens to any of us. If we blow a conch shell, or if we just hum or sing or play a flute or something that gets this vibratory quality going in our nervous system, he gets this full embodied experience of the vibratory sense of being grounded because he's blown air through the conch shell, which is an exhale, and that helps him to get his feet firmly on the ground, which is the nature of the exhale. And then he's feeling the vibration inside, which is the sound, the resonance. And suddenly there's a pause, and he starts to wake up to the fact that, wait a minute, is this really the best action I can be taking, even though I've trained for this my whole life? And at that moment, his gut feeling of something is not right here arises. And that's the very beginning of the book, where he asks Krishna then to draw the chariot up between the armies, because he's saying, wait a minute, let's look at this again. And so for all of us, when we're in moments of anxiety and stress or whatever, if we can take a deep breath out, and if you happen to have a conch shell, blow it. And if not, you know, just even humming or doing a couple of deep breaths and just making a sound, it can give you the strength you need to get a little bit more clear.
Yes. In reading your book, I just started laughing and feeling like a great wedding present would be to give a couple his and hers conch shells.
That's a wonderful idea.
Anyway.
Good one.
I like that you pose this question, what do we risk if we do not hold human beings in our heart? And once again, it's not stated as a teaching, and this is what we must do. It's not a dogma. It's something to pick out and look at. And certainly the Gita has done that throughout eons of time. And thank you both for bringing all of this to us in our modern times. And I think that word modern maybe has to be redefined.
Modern.
What does modern mean anyway?
Changes every day. Yeah.
Is there something either of you would like to say, either about the book or the Gita or writing or anything that I could share that you would like to see put out there? Or
I think one thing is what we learned from it and what we hope others will learn from it is, one of the things we hope is, you know, all these ideas of finding the essence of love in the core of the heart, et cetera, and inviting others in to the core of the heart, not throwing people out of your heart. But another thing, too, is really, truly always, always look again, look more deeply. Don't be afraid to do that. Don't be too in your comfort zone and think it's not important to look again. At the very, very end of the Gita, that's a message that is very strongly put forth and is often not even mentioned in
commentaries. Yeah, that you're supposed to look again, look again, look again. And then look again, Arjuna. And then some smritya. He uses the word smriti, which is the word in Pali sati, which is the word for mindfulness. And so you should be mindful again, and then mindful and continue to be mindful. And another thing that Arjuna was, he's like a two-year-old. He was always asking questions. Like, you tell him why, and he goes, why? In any answer you give, he keeps looking more deeply. He'll say, well, who are you? And you tell him, and then he'll go, no, who are you? And whatever you say, he's going, no, who are you, the real you?
Yes.
Why? Why ask why? That's the awakened mind. Keep asking. It's a big topic. Whatever this topic is, it's a big one.
Mary Taylor and Richard Freeman. And as a heads up, Mary's an incredible chef, and there's recipes on their website. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on iTunes as Tributaries Radio. And if we're not where you are for your favorite podcasts, let us know. This is Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.